Well, welcome to another edition of Northern Conversations. My name is John Jurisic. I'm with Kelly Darwin. Kelly, how are you?
I'm fantastic, John. How are you?
Well, I'm really great. This podcast has garnered a ton of interest. We didn't realize how fascinating folks are with the stories, the Indigenous First Nations stories. So it became painfully obvious that we need to interview Adam Olson. Adam Olson, hi Adam.
He's painful? Right here.
That was quite the segue.
Painfully obvious that there were too many people asking us to do. Adam Olson and I have known each other for a while. When you were a municipal councillor at Central Saanich.
That's right.
You then became MLA for Saanich and the Islands, Gulf Islands, correct?
Saanich North and the Islands.
Saanich North and the Islands. Along the way to the races, you were well, originally a member of the Green Party. I think you're the first MLA?
No. Andrew Weaver got elected as the first Green, provincial Green MLA. I was, I guess, probably the second.
And you were interim leader?
I was the interim leader. I am, again,
the interim leader.
Always the interim leader.
Well, boy, the party needs you. The party, you've done an amazing job of when your party's in transition, you've been there for them. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's right.
And you and I have kept in touch.
That's right.
And lately, you've been involved in some issues up north and up in northern BC. And so we wanted to chat with you about that today.
Yeah, sure.
Explain to folks maybe what they don't know, some education or what's going on. Because when I talk to folks, I hear a lot of, well, gee, there are 20 nations that want a pipeline to be built. Man, they need the jobs. Come on, let's go. Giddy up. And there's Adam Olson not entirely saying the opposite message, but you're saying a message. Yeah. And I think there needs to be a lot of clarity around what's going on.
Yeah, and I mean, you change the channel and then you hear the opposite story.
Right.
So we're living in an age of you can pick the facts you want to hear.
Yeah.
So I think we're here today to hear a little bit more of a firsthand count. What's the real story? What's going on?
And I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation, gentlemen, because I think there's a lot of, I'll just say there's a lot of information. And I think to the point that you're making, there's a lot of information based on, people can access the information that they want. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's important is that we kind of confront how we got to where we are with some honesty, and that the only way that we are actually going to be able to improve the broader conversation that's going on in this province right now and the relationships is through honesty and is through maybe being able to hear some things that we don't want to hear and saying, okay, well, if that's the case, then we're going to have to lean in and we've got some work to do. To get it to where we want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for the longest time, we've just pretended like everything's okay and that the problems will go away. And we've realized that, and I guess I'm kind of speaking coded here, we've kind of taken the perspective that the challenges that the Indigenous, non-Indigenous relationships, this very dysfunctional relationship, which has been legislated, will just go away. And it hasn't. Court case after court case after court case has kept it in front of us and to some cases made the problem more a more sophisticated problem than there was in the past. And we owe it, I've always taken the position that we owe it to future generations that they don't inherit the problem that we've inherited.
Right. And it's interesting, like we can say all that and all of that points to both pipelines right now that are in the news, right? Because Trans Mountain just went through the court case. We're talking about the Coastal Link. It's the same problem with both projects, but on different levels.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that one of the points that I often get asked about is the difference between hereditary leadership and elected band councils.
Mm-hmm.
I've used a couple of analogies in this. You know, the municipal government that I was initially on in Central Saanich is a legislated body through the provincial government, through the Local Government Act. It's actually not really a level of government. It's a sub-level of the provincial government, for all intents and purposes. I don't choose to look at it that way. I think that local government's really important. A form of government that is the most accountable to the people. Monday nights, you can go to your council meeting and talk to your local council.
I think the whole intent was that local people would be better able to serve the local issues around around the roads and some of the water and some of the density issues that wouldn't be able to be captured by a provincial voice.
And it's also the kind of issues that you can talk about on a Monday and see in action on a Wednesday or Thursday.
So it's
not provincial or federal where we're saying, well, in 3 years we're going to be completing this project.
What I want to look at here is the difference in talking about the difference between the hereditary and the elected governments is that what's important is the band councils are were manufactured by the federal government. Historically they don't exist. Through the Indian Act bands were created to govern reserves. Indian Act reserves. I grew up on one. Sartlip is an Indian Act reserve. It is a creation of the federal government. So when Indigenous nations, Indigenous people, kind of look at the types of government that level of government is one that they see as imposed on from, for all intents and purposes, imposed on from the federal government. Every Indigenous nation in this province had a very sophisticated Indigenous
governance.
Mm-hmm. They had laws that governed how they operated. In the creation of and
they weren't eliminated. In the creation of a band council, the other governance wasn't eliminated.
Well, and in fact,
a lot of people don't know this.
And the courts have continued to uphold through various court decisions that they still have authority.
The hereditary council governance, yes.
Indigenous law still has a standing.
Mm-hmm.
In
right,
the country.
Indigenous
it's part
law.
Of the, it's part yeah. of the legal framework of this country is, yeah. right. is Indigenous laws.
Yeah.
So I think, the analogy that I often use is like if you were to build a pipeline through this province and only go and sign agreements with the municipalities and not talk to the province, do you think the province would have an issue with that?
Mm.
Do you think that the pipeline would be built if the company said, oh yeah, don't worry about it, province. We've signed agreements with all the municipalities or most of the municipalities, if not all the municipalities along the route. But we didn't go through your approval process. Yeah. We didn't ask you for permits.
Right.
I think what's really important is that we recognize that we're saying essentially the same thing by not engaging the hereditary leaderships. Especially up in that area. I mean, Delgamuukw is one of these landmark cases which fundamentally put us on the course that we're on to pass Bill 41 in the last fall session, where the Supreme Court of Canada has been consistently saying, politicians, you got to figure this out, because if it keeps coming to the courts, it's going to be a problem in terms of the future of this country. And so I think, you know, we're kind of kidding ourselves if every time I read an article, it's like the hereditary chiefs say this, but 20 band councils have signed an agreement. We certainly would not accept that if it was the provincial government is in opposition to this, but 22 local governments have signed agreements. It just simply wouldn't fly.
And ask this question just because I don't know the mechanics of it, but the band council, they're elected by members of that band? Or are they appointed, or how does that
work? No, they're elected. It's a democratic process. Like, my sister's on one of the band councils, and I think what's important is to undermine one, and this is how it's often put. Oh, you know, and people will look at this and say, oh, you know, Olson is undermining elected councils. No, I'm not here to undermine. My sister's on a chief and council that's elected through the Indian Act. They've done a great job for our community. And I have often said, and I believe this in my heart, that indigenous leaders elected in that system are some of the most important and courageous leaders that we have in our province. Mm-hmm. They do more with less than any other leaders in our province. They are handed some of the absolute most devastatingly challenging social issues than any communities in this province. So I am not here to undermine the substantively challenging position that those communities are and those leaders are put under. I am simply saying it is wrong for us to say that this is good because of that.
Right.
We have to say that the situation that we're facing is more complex than that. It should not be simplified. And it's actually the situation that we inherited today has been an oversimplification of a complex relationship that has existed over the past couple hundred years.
But now, okay. Well, then let's dig into this a little bit, as opposed to even the core issue of whether the pipeline should go through there or not. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the governance, because really that's seems to be where most of the at least media reported conflict is coming from.
And these, the confusion.
Right, these two. So are there demographic differences between the two governances? Are the hereditary leaders from an older generation, are they generally different in age? Because when we do labor market work, or Kelly and I are interviewing companies, often this notion of there's an older leadership that doesn't understand the young people that are working on the manufacturing line. And so this is not just unique to an indigenous population. So I'm really coming from, can we represent the scenario up in the north like that, that the hereditary leaders are generally older and potentially band council members are younger and there's some culture clash happening here?
So what I'll say to this is I'm not an expert in any indigenous nations' hereditary systems. In fact, one of the biggest challenges that I've had over the last year and a half are people demanding that I go up and represent their position, you know, on behalf of these hereditary leaders or those hereditary leaders.
Oh.
And I say, look.
Why do they ask you?
Well, because I'm a political figure.
Okay.
I'm an indigenous person who's an MLA and part of this confidence. And
I mean, I know the answer was obvious, but I just needed to double check.
But I just say this to it. We've passed a bill now that requires it requires indigenous people and governments to develop the right to self-determination.
Yeah, is that the UNDRIP?
The UNDRIP? Yeah. Well,
the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous
People. Our bill is called the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act.
Okay.
And this is the first time in the history of this country where we haven't been dictating to indigenous people and indigenous communities how they're to be governed.
Right.
We've said, you can be governed how you define it. You can, mm-hmm. Your education system is how you define it. Your membership is how you define it. Right now, the membership of the community that I'm from is defined by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing could be more paternalistic or colonial than that.
Yeah.
Right? So for the first time in the history of this country, we have said, look, the definition is not ours to determine, it's yours to determine. Like, I don't think there's a people in this province that thinks that that is, you know, wrong-headed in its approach.
Except when the control of the decision-making is given to people who are disagreeing, and that then there's no vehicle by which to mediate the disagreement. That's sort of seen. So if you have two governance processes and control is given, so in other words, back to our original analogy, so let's just say in the municipality of Central Saanich, there are two ways in which to get a building permit, and one of them says you can't, and one says you can. Now what? What's your reaction to that? Like, now what do we do?
Well, I mean, we've largely been in a situation here where where we have been entirely in a situation where there's only one group to talk to.
Right. Is that and the band council?
The band council. Mm-hmm. You know, and they have represented the villages for the most part. They represent the governance in the village. There has always been a large question that the Supreme Court of Canada has always been struggling with in terms of the broader territories that those people have been and were collected from and put on these postage stamp reserves. So,
the hereditary chiefs represent a different boundaries than the bands?
Well, I think that's up to them to determine.
But is that the case right now?
I don't know.
So are the hereditary chiefs representative of, let's say, 10 bands?
Maybe.
Wow.
I mean, I think this
is a murky soup.
Well, not
governance wise.
Well, but hold on a second.
Governance wise.
Hold on a second.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hold
okay.
on a second.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always been a murky suit.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
We've pretended like.
Well, maybe I'm characterizing that from my eyes.
Well,
maybe
no,
it's not
no,
a murky soup.
It always has
oh,
been
has
a murky
it? Okay.
soup.
Okay.
But we've pretended like it's not. We've said,
okay.
Oh, we'll just talk to the group that we created.
Okay.
And right. there's been great, great internal strife within Indigenous communities.
Really?
Over the fact that, you know, who has the authority?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Who doesn't have the authority?
So
what we've said in our province is, let us know, figure it out, work it through. Like,
and is that your message when you went up there?
Well,
your message was to
no.
Look, there's a decision making here.
I went.
We can't solve it for you. Can you please? I'm here to help facilitate that.
Nope.
No.
My message, I had no message when I went up there. I went up there with a great deal of humility to understand what my goal in that was. I grew up on a reserve. I grew up under the Indian Act Band Council. I know the conditions that those leaders are making decisions under. I know the conditions in our communities across the province. I wanted to go up and learn about the Wet'suwet'en Indigenous, the history of the Indigenous, their sophisticated governance structure that has existed for hundreds of thousands of years. I went up to learn about this hereditary system. I came back no expert in it. I came back only slightly more educated than I was. But what I did understand was that it's a completely different perspective than the one that we view governance in, and it's one, in fact, which I think our modern British Columbia society could learn a lot from. As an example, one of the things that I learned about that governance structure was that the hereditary system, the being a hereditary chief is a position of burden. And I think that as an elected official, if we could view our positions less as the benefits that it derives us and more as the burden that we carry on behalf of our community, we would govern it, our province, in a different way. I look at there's a situation that I think a misunderstanding that the hereditary system is somewhat equitable to the monarchy, which we have, that there's a someone sitting on a throne making executive decisions on behalf of the people. One of the very important lessons that I learned was that the actual definition of that job is one of a, and the way it was explained to me was it's the big push. I say the big push. What does the big push mean? Well, the decision is made amongst the families in the house, and the job of the hereditary chief is to deliver the message to the people.
Mm. To represent the families.
To represent them.
And to be the voice, the speaker of the decision that was made. So when you ask the question, is this a difference between generational, that this hereditary leader might make a decision? What's important to understand my understanding, as it was explained to me, was that their job is to deliver the message, not to make the decision.
Yeah,
and so
there's actually very democratic.
In that there's
fair representation. That nobody's elected. But technically, if there's 10 families, the problem becomes if potentially one or two of the families is is much stronger than the others.
Right.
Well, I think that we have to be very careful in that we hazard and risk in evaluating what it is that's going on, undermining it. Or trying to.
Well, I think oversimplify it.
Yeah, I just think
because I am.
I think what my goal was in going up there was to get it was like a 24-hour trip, a 30-hour trip. So
well, what amplified it was as soon as you got back, the highways shut down, and so people made the link. You go up, protesters. It's Adam Olson's fault. Without knowing a damn thing.
Well, so that was dog whistle.
Right.
That was the most unfortunate
and unfair.
Least information. It was ridiculous.
Right.
And
that's why we're doing this, to get an understanding of what's happening.
You know, like there was nothing politically motivating those statements. Come on. Ridiculous.
I know.
The statements were ridiculous.
But we live in a day and age now when people see 7 seconds and their entire decision making is based on that.
And look, my job in going up there was as a provincial MLA, and as I said in the media, the fact that I went up there celebrated is absurd. There are 87 MLAs in this province. And they're not going up and investigating that situation and trying to understand the complex and sophisticated governance structure.
Yeah.
Then who's doing the job?
Right out of the gate, I think this is an important message from this podcast, is that you went up there to investigate and understand. There is a misunderstanding that you went up there to support the hereditary chiefs and not the other 20 bands that the other councils. And so let's just get that out of the frickin' way. So that's fantastic, too. See, this is how we started. We don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I went up to go and learn. Have I ever said that I stand with or do it? No, it's not my job.
No. So what's next?
My job is to respect the decisions that... So what's interesting about this? My job is to respect the decisions that were made by the courts. And so they said, well, okay, hold on a second. The BC Supreme Court's made an injunction for this pipeline. The Supreme Court of Canada made a decision about Delgamuukw-Kosteaway case back in the late 1990s, right? So part of the real challenge that I face with this, with the very intimate understanding that I have of the Indian Act, how it's impacted the lives of me and my family and the people, is that we cannot. It is inappropriate and wrong to pick and choose which court cases we're going to say work for us and which court cases work against us. Right. And that, frankly, gentlemen, is what the provincial and federal governments have been doing for a very long time, and to the detriment of this province. And so I'm sure that there's a lot of people in my riding that are confused, and in ridings across, and frankly,
and not just
across Canada.
And not about just this issue, but any issue.
Yeah. That's,
now we get like the CNN moment all the time. Well, that's the life we're in.
I have a responsibility to do a job, and that job is to, as intimately as I can, understand the full complexity of the problem. And I happen to be part of a governance structure and a political system that for the past two decades has been simplifying everything. It's all about jobs. It's all about economic development. It's all about this or that simple message. This narrative or that narrative that sells, that helps push people to my party or their, and to move them away from that party. That fundamentally is the thing that is letting us down. And so I can understand why people are confused. I can understand why people are emotional about, I know why people are emotional about the ferries being shut down. Really not a very smart, in my opinion, not a very smart decision on behalf of people who are standing in support of someone where they turn the public against it. That's not a smart thing to do. Although, on the other hand, we have the right to peaceful assembly in this, and it was the police did their job, and it was over. Yeah.
I mean, I've been advocating on behalf of Peninsula businesses for about 10 years, and on issues of affordable housing and transportation and skilled trades, there is a business of advocacy. It's an entire business, and within it are strategies on how to get your message to the public.
And how not to. Mm-hmm.
And how not to. Okay. So it's not just this issue. It is a way that somebody has chosen to highlight this issue and, frankly, as your friend, took advantage of you. Okay? That was not by coincidence. That was the day after that happened. Okay? That was a natural link. And I personally am annoyed with that. They took advantage of what you were doing and the misunderstanding of why you were up there.
Well, okay. Misrepresenting it.
Now, but what's next? How do we get those two governance systems to agree on what's next? There or anywhere in BC?
Well, everybody's talking now too that it's coming to a tipping point. And we're gonna be victims of the same comments we're making of oversimplifying it. Is we can't come up with a solution on a podcast, but what is next down the road to start something? Because right now it's a standoff, right? So how do we fix that?
What do you think? We should remove fix. No. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll tell you what.
Yeah, you're right.
I'll tell you what. My work is going to be to demand more accountability in the way we talk about this at a provincial government level. Glib statements are not helpful.
Uninformed statements.
Deal. You know, statements like, this is a done deal, this is going to happen anyway, you should get over it, should get on with it, those kind of statements are not helpful. Again, those are simplifying statements that only further inflame a situation that doesn't need more flames on it. So that's the first thing.
Yeah.
The second thing is that this situation has taken 180 years or 200 years. In British Columbia, it's a fairly young situation. It's the last
province,
the last province, the last British colony in Canada. I think only Hong Kong is a more recent British colony than British Columbia.
Hmm.
I think we have to understand that even though this is a fairly recent phenomenon in this province, that it has evolved over a number of generations, and that just because we've made the decision that we're going to pass the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act, and that a growing population of people in British Columbia have become sympathetic to the challenges that Indigenous people have faced for a number of generations, doesn't mean that this problem fixes itself overnight. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the challenges with our modern society is we've made the decision that we want it to change, so why hasn't it changed? Right? And it's like, well, it should change now because we decided that it's going to change.
Yeah. No, you and I've had these discussions a lot over
this
time.
This is a situation that plays out through patience.
So I'm gonna use the misunderstanding point of view.
Sure.
I'm coming from a misunderstanding, lack of knowledge point of view. Okay. So if I'm given the advice that helping solve this scenario is to have patience and to work together, I don't see an outcome of that. I don't know how you get to the finish line. I know that's a misinformed opinion, but it is the opinion of a lot of people.
But also, like when you look on, say, Facebook and you see news posts, and this is where it's misinformed facts being informed to people directly, you see video of people with jerry cans and tires and cutting trees. And we saw a story of professional protesters from Ontario coming out and setting these things up. I understand patience and time to make the two sides, or all the sides, because we're talking governments and councils and hereditary chiefs and everybody, work together, but what do we do right now about those things that we see being misinformed? But also, it we're starting to fall, I think, a little bit into that media frenzy we see south of the border, where now we see imminent danger because that gets clicks and it gets views, and people watch that video because they think something's going to happen and it's going to be bad. So patience is not going to fix that panicky feeling that people are getting from the news. What do we do about that right now? Like, what's
I think you and I and Adam are doing something directly about it, trying to use digital means to educate people.
Yeah.
I mean, I've learned more in an hour here than I have in 3 to 4 months of watching this news on TV or whatever.
Well, and perspective makes the truth.
That's the issue, right? As a business consultant, as someone who's owned business all my life, there have been terrible conflicts between staff in the businesses I've run. And what I have done is I've said, we're all going to get into one room and we're going to accelerate communication, not decrease communication. We're going to talk more about the issue, not hide it or ignore it. That has worked every single time. What is the difference between that and what you're advocating?
Well,
because there's no solution to that. Just all, let's get in a room and talk about it. There's no solution to that. But it works.
Right.
This is not, I mean, to the greatest extent, this is not on the indigenous people of this province. This is on this province. This is on the provincial government that we elect. Mm-hmm. That's where the responsibility of this falls. Now, and this provincial government made a decision to proceed with LNG Canada. Did they do the business? Did they address the 20-year issues with the Wet'suwet'en people, the Delgamuukw Stay Away case, the one where the court said you need to go back and retry this, and the Wet'suwet'en people went into the treaty process, and only after last January where we're seeing those really awful images that nobody in this province likes to see, where the police are moving in, is there a table struck for the first time in the history of this province? A table is struck to have a conversation about the Delgamuukw case.
So
they've been floundering, and
the simplest of solutions is the most complex of solutions, and one you're advocating for, more dialogue.
Well, like
that's what
like,
you've been saying,
I think,
right?
Absolutely, and I think,
and I'm
think
reinforcing that because that's actually what business does.
We need to stop. We need to, in my opinion, we need to put the responsibility where it lays. When that decision was made, I just asked the question because I don't have a great answer for it. But I just asked the question. When the decision was made to go and make the announcement that this provincial government, which is different from the first provincial government that was working on LNG, made the decision to approve LNG Canada, and there was all the wonderful pictures that were taken with the leadership of this province and the leadership of Canada, and happy to announce all of that, was the job done? When we ask the question about what's going on up there in the Wet'suwet'en territory right now, it's very easy to blame the indigenous people who are confusing with their leadership and their governance and all that. Let's ask of our government that we elect 87 members of this legislature, was the job done? Now, the courts have said the permits were filed, but were the social issues
obviously
dealt with?
Not.
Well, and the fact that you're the only MLA that's gone up there on a mission to understand speaks loudly
volumes
of where our problem in communication lies. We can even point out leadership's been up there and wouldn't meet with them. So that sends its own specific message.
Since I was up there, there's been a table struck. The Minister of Indigenous Relations has been up there a bunch of times.
Okay.
Right? So, I mean...
So well done.
Like, part of my work was to say, look, we need to be up here. And being up here and being visible up here... had its impact in whatever way it had its impact, and whatever happens here with the local issues, this is a hazardous business that I'm in, right? So that's fine.
Well,
I accept that. The question is, though, is that it's so easy to say that the indigenous people of this province and this country haven't got it figured out. I think what it's much more difficult to acknowledge and to accept is that a lot of the confusion has been created by the laws that the federal government created through the Indian Act, and that a lot of the confusion has been created because we've not had the dialogue over the period of time to sort it out.
Mm-hmm.
And we just expect it all to go away. And it never has gone away. And at what point are we going to say expecting it to go away is just not good enough?
So then our podcast today, which frankly we hope might be one of a series with you,
is a
pebble on a beach of conversations that are going on to better understand and to better work towards a solution for all communities. And how about we leave it at that?
Yeah,
that that's where we're at.
Because
really that's what's being... Is that not what you're... That's what we're all wanting to better understand and have everyone be involved in a solution.
And most challenges come from lack of communication. And by you going up there, you've started the conversation. So it's great to hear that ministers are going up there, and hopefully more, and we can continue the conversation and get a better understanding, because it sounds to me like the root of all of these problems or all of these challenges is that people aren't talking to each other.
We have some very divisive, intentionally divisive legislation that has created internal strife in Indigenous communities deliberately, so that then narratives can be constructed that continue to divide, that continue to simplify. When this podcast started, it was pointed out that there's two pipelines. What's really fascinating that is not being pointed out, that while the Indian Act band councils are being celebrated as in full support of one pipeline, that there's Indian Act band councils that are being chastised as being outside of supportive of the other pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So even in the narratives through the media and through our government officials and through everybody, even the narratives are not consistent with each other, but it doesn't matter. Because forever in this country, the burden, the bucket of water has been carried by Indigenous people. And they've
Well, that's got to end.
Absolutely.
And we're doing our little pebble on the beach to try to end that.
And you wanted positive conversations in this.
Yes, yes.
And this has largely been one of, it is what it is.
Research.
Yeah. But I'll research. Say this. Let me end with this. Because in 2008, I got elected as a counselor in the District of Central Saanich. My sister was on Sartlip First Nations Council for a year before that. And we had our first meeting. It was a community-to-community forum, and it was one of the toughest meetings that I ever had because it became very clear to me how much division there was between the First Nation reserve that I grew up in and the community that I love and grew up in Central Saanich. And really, we live right on the border, right on the other side of the road is the other side. We live on the reserve, on the other side of the road
is the municipality. Saanich, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And we're technically, Sartlip is technically within the District of Central Saanich. It highlighted to me just how little communication there was between the municipality and the First Nation community. When I went to the UBCM, it highlighted to me just how far apart local governments and First Nations were right across the country, right across the province. It was an emotional experience for me. It was very sad to see,
the disconnect.
My heritage, the conflict between, my mom's side of the family, which is a European background, and my dad's side of the family, which is of Indigenous background, the conflict between the two parts of me.
Mm-hmm.
I went through, I got reelected, and in 2012, I Don't Know More happened. And this was really the first point look at to say a sea change started to happen in our country. And so in the decade that I've been in governance, there has been a massive change in this. So while I am still lamenting ancient legislation which has created division in our communities, the confusion which has been created that has come out of it, the substantial challenges that we're facing with various pipeline projects that were brought forward under one set of rules and now, you know, there's other sets of rules. Through that, Idle No More happens, a massive sea change, people starting to understand indigenous cultures in ways that they haven't. My time in the legislature has really been marked with standing up and speaking Senchoffin language. Others, the lieutenant governor, her honor, coming in and speaking Senchoffin, the representative of the queen, learning the language of this local place with a pure heart in a way that in a way that's never happened before. The previous lieutenant governor leaving and saying, the biggest work that we have in front of us now is reconciliation and finding a way forward in this. And then culminating that with saying, we actually have to change the laws in our country so that what happened in the Wet'suwet'en, in the Wet'suwet'en territory, what happened with Coastal GasLink, what happened with Trans Mountain, can't happen again. We have to fundamentally change the way that we dialogue and engage people. That has changed. The Bill 41, now the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act, has fundamentally changed the way the rules of engagement, and the decisions that are going to be coming out of that will be different. Now, we are in this weird period of time right now where there's this expectation on one side that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act fundamentally changed what happened in the past overnight. And we've been consistently saying, that's not realistic, it's not possible. It's not going to happen. This is actually about a long-term project. The long-term project that got us to where we're at today is going to require a long-term project to undo and get us to a different place where we hopefully want to be in the future. So all of this, all the emotion, all the frustration that I've expressed in this, all of the frustration that has been expressed about me and to me about this or about that, about whatever, I accept, because we've been accepting that forever. What I don't accept is that 20 years from now that we're in exactly the same position that we're in today. I don't accept that. And so that's the work that I've been doing to try to make those changes.
Well, Kelly, I think we've been lucky to hear from Adam today. Mm-hmm. And I think we're better people than an hour ago, because we understand what we didn't know.
Right.
And that is what we're here to do, is to try to educate and bring some detail to what our, you know, we both Kelly and I are involved with social media, marketing and branding and promoting, and know how it's changed the way we disseminate information. And so therefore we have to break through that.
Yeah.
And I hope we can continue a dialogue with you.
You better put a pretty killer title on this, or else nobody's going to listen to it. Because you know, the way to attract someone's attention on social media is...
Oh, I think we'll get attention.
To make a killer headline.
Yeah.
Adam, thank you. Thank you so much. Till we chat again. See you, bud.